This is Iconic.
This episode is going to be talking about monsters and how to use them in both Glorantha campaigns and in your Dragon Empire game. All right, Mark, take us into our next creature, the Spirits of Reprisal. And then I think Evan and I will talk a little bit about what they are in a non-chaotic setting. So,
yeah, so the world is full of spirits. Sometimes they remind worshippers that they've fallen short of their god's virtues. And in this case, since we're talking about chaos, some of those spirits have been twisted by chaos. And it seems for some reason, and maybe you guys can talk about this later, those followers of Orlan seem to be hit harder for some reason. So this is another one of those creatures that kind of key off of runes. There's three in a book, and two of them kind of have more ability. They can fly if there's a follower of Orlan in the group. Otherwise, they can only walk. So that makes a difference right there. So if you have no one in the group that's a follower or has the air rune, then they're going to walk. If you've got someone that has that, they're going to fly at least until they're staggered. So that makes it a little bit harder to fight them, or easier to fight them, you could say. I found them just kind of looking through them. I've never run into them, not having played a whole lot of Glorantha. They're definitely one of the weaker monsters. They're not going to send you screaming into the night like Brew and Scorpion Men. But at low levels, they'll definitely be a threat. This is definitely where I would use some of those optional weirdness tables at the beginning of the chaos section to give them a little bit more, maybe more punch or just some more weirdness to it. Otherwise, that nothing too weird about them. I didn't find anything too. And it's kind of the same with the Nangra. They weren't too weird compared to the other creatures in this section that are very weird. These are a spirit, which is a little weird, but it's a spirit. It's not, a slavering monster with tentacles and acid saliva.
In Glorantha, what a Spirit of Reprisal, the role that plays, say, in more of a RuneQuest game, is the fact that if you break your, when you join a cult, go check out our episode on cults on Exploring Glorantha, episode 4. When you break with the cult, the gods send out Spirits of Reprisal, and that is to hunt you down. We talked about it in the episode. They hunt you down. They inflict horrific curses on those who break vows or share the secrets, the initiation secrets of the cult. And so I think the reason that we see so many air rune reprisals is, again, Chaos Rising setting takes place in Dragon Pass, where the majority of the people are Orlanth. And so these are the spirits of Orlanth that Orlanth has sent out into the world to kind of keep the keep his followers pointed where they need to be. And yet, by being sent out into the world, Chaos has found their hooks and turned them from a useful part of the cult network, right? This is how you deal with vow breakers, with secret sharers, with those who forsake the cults, usually by turning to a chaotic cult. And instead, they hound the people who belong to this cult.
It's another example of chaos subverting the natural order, and in this case, the divine order. You know, what can be a worse robbery of, here are the faithful spirits that are to guide and punish those who commit crimes against the cult, and those are instead, sort of reprogrammed and repurposed by chaos to turn against the faithful and actually be more powerful in the presence of those whose morals and spiritual well-being they're supposed to be enforcing and protecting, and instead they're more powerful and can kill you worse when you face them.
Well, the next chaos creature is my favorite. Beckana, I'm going to lean on you to kind of chat about this with me, because they're featuring very heavily in all of the Glorantha games that I've ever run. They are the Thanatari. And what's really interesting about the Thanatari is they're actually three different groups of people who all sort of worship different gods, yet they all worship the same god, although each individual cult would argue that they probably don't. Thanatar is a god who is beheaded in the Mythic Age. And so there are people who worship Thanatar. There are people who just worship his head, Atyar, and there are some who just worship his body. And so the three together form this group of Thanatari. And the reason they are just terrifying is, one, the Atyar branch, they oppose Lenkor Mai, the god of knowledge. Maybe not any, but most of the Glorantha books have a blessing from Lenkor Mai at the front of it, right? Like, that this knowledge is useful and put to good use and remains in the world. The Thanatari want to hoard and destroy everyone else's access to knowledge. But even more, they feed into that same fear that the Brew and the Scorpion Men are. These are the guys, these are headhunters. But they don't just take your head. They take all of you. They trap your soul in your head so you can't move on to the afterlife. And they put all of your magic and all of your knowledge and all of your information into their service. Now, Becca, you've encountered these in our Glorantha game. What are your thoughts on the Thanatari?
They need to be put down and destroyed is really where I'm going with this. They are right outside of my clan, and I am not okay with it at all. So in our RuneQuest game, they are terrifying. And I feel like the 13th Age Glorantha options that are here do a good job of demonstrating that. In the RuneQuest Glorantha game, the heads the Thanatari have are some of my own clansmen. In this, in 13th Age, you can actually kind of figure out who your Thanatari enemies would have on them, what kind of heads they would have, whether that is an Orlanthi priest or a lunar magician or a wind lord from 200 years ago. And so they have just a variety of heads that the Thanatari can use in addition to what each of the monsters can already do.
Yeah, they basically have an equipment list for the Thanatari that are all severed heads, and each severed head has their own power. And then the list of nastier specials that only apply to the Thanatari are amazing. Death energy, when a cultist drops to zero, it fights until it hits negative 20, 40, or 80 hit points. And while it's at negative hit points, it actually gains a bonus to its attack rolls against you. Now, it takes damage as it kind of exists in this negative state, but it's the, oh, you killed it. Don't worry, it's still coming for you.
Yeah. Or even just the Acolyte of Atyar, one of their just natural abilities, it's not even a nastier special, but one of their abilities is to steal power. And if you as a PC miss the Acolyte with an attack, the Acolyte can use it against you because they're more knowledgeable than you are. And they go, no, this is how it works. Let me show you. Yes.
It's also really cool because they give you, like, the Thanatari are presented in this book as a campaign level threat. So you get, like, a campaign arc idea with the Thanatari. You also get, like, here's a bunch of other monsters that would be associated with this cult. Now, Nick, you said you had a mechanical question. I would love to hear it.
So sure, the question is kind of along the lines of, in a worst case scenario, like, no GM would ever do this, but if a Thanatari stole a PC's head, right, that's the summation of kind of their soul, they're not allowed to move on to the afterlife, how does that tie in with the 13th Age Glorantha heroic return rules?
Well, first of all, why is everyone looking at me when Nick asked that question about being an evil GM? For me, I would not allow a heroic return until the group hunts down that Thanatar cultist and gets their head back, because there is no return as long as your head is bound. I mean, what are some of your guys' thoughts?
I mean, that was kind of my initial, I mean, that's how I probably would have answered it at initial stab. At the same time, I think that if they were to ever go up against the Thanatari has been using the head, like using the knowledge in there, using the powers that the PC had, that they've used up the person's soul. Like, and maybe there just is no possibility for a heroic return at all. Just if you're laid there long enough and your players or the other players didn't come and rescue you and you got your head chopped off as in the middle of combat, then I'm sorry, give you the death salute, roll up a new character. Again, trying to emphasize these are
now who's the evil GM?
These are bad people.
I'd let them recover the head. Kind of like, you know, if your friend gets taken by a brew, it's your job to go put them down before things happen. And in this case, I would have them recover the head. If they really want to help, they'd go recover the head, do a, you know, burial ritual, let the soul pass on, and then you can, you know, do your hero quest, do something different. But yeah, if they never recover the head, sorry. Kind of like if you can't recover the body, you can't do resurrection in the old F20 games, you know, if you don't have something from the body. So we know who your friends are.
I guess my thought of, I think you everybody is, you know, pitch perfect and right about the, you know, blocking the heroic return. But I can imagine under the right circumstances that maybe something else returns, because what has happened is, so, you know, this is a hero and something has to, you know, fill that void in the world. And so then maybe the gods send a spirit, an ally, you know, a placeholder, of like, you know, this hero should have returned. And then its sole purpose is, you know, we've got to free the hero to go back into the cycle. And, you know, that gives, you know, a mechanic to, you know, maybe bring someone back, but have, it's like the shaman's fetch or the, you know, rune lord's allied spirit, you know, their spirit brother or double shows up and says, okay, but the only thing we're going to do is go get so-and-so's head, right? Because that's what we've got to do, like right now, every day, all the time. And I could see that, you know, with the right group, that might be an interesting way of both, you know, dealing with the reality of the captured hero, but allowing someone then to play through and have the benefit of that, that rule for continuity.
I really like that idea a lot. All right, so wrapping up our discussion of each of the chaos monsters and sort of what they represent and where they're at, Evan, I'm going to turn this one over to you. I have used this monster several times to great effect. The Woctopus, which, if you're wondering what it looks like, imagine a wingless Cthulhu, keeping it in the Chaosium family. Chaosium, who does RuneQuest, who does Call of Cthulhu, who, 13th Age Glorantha is available there. They named their company after the font of chaos in Glorantha. So it does still have this idea of potentiality, unbounded, which is, again, incremental to creation. But just remember, they named their company after this idea in Glorantha. So, Evan, talk to us about Woctopi.
Yeah. Woctopi. Okay, well, you know, yeah. You know, take an octopus, and replace a human being's head with the octopus, and there you have a tremendous chaos horror. And of course, there are a couple of key features of Woctopi. One, they regenerate, and they regenerate a lot. They regenerate, you know, if you thought, you know, trolls were bad, these are like trolls on steroids. For regeneration. And so that makes them very, very scary. And then they also have poison gas, acidic gas, you know, instead of like as a defensive mechanism, an octopus in nature would be able to put out an ink cloud. This thing puts out a cloud into the air or in the water that's poisonous, acidic, or just chaotic, just stuff that comes after you and hurts you. And some of them are fairly mindless, you know, sort of ravening beasts that walk out of the wilds, the swamp lands, infected by chaos. But then as we move up, you know, some of them are smart, which is even more terrifying. and can just do you know, all sorts of terrifying things. They get bigger, you know, beyond human size, you know, sort of small, giantish size, and facing something like that. And then if you're a real polished evil DM like Nick, you know, you might extrapolate beyond just having a wactopus like and have, you know, like a scorpion man eat the wactopus and then have a scorpion wactopus, which is not something that's presented to us, but it just sort of naturally flows.
Yeah, I say we set that up, Adam. We'll stat that up and put that on the iconic guaranteed blog. Guaranteed.
Why would you say that? Why would you say that?
Terrifying enough as they were.
I'm just in the zone. Yeah, you are. Now, I used a octopi in our Glorantha game, Becca, and I tried to telegraph how dangerous these things were by having it rip a horse in half before the players had an opportunity to run. They did not take it, and so the next thing that got ripped in half was one of the two PCs, and then the other one was like, well, that's two things that got ripped in half. I'm not going to make it a third. And this guy left all of his gear and his companion, who is basically already dead, to be consumed, right? You don't have to run faster than the Woctopi. You just have to walk faster than the rest of the party.
Yep, and that experience caused that character to retire, and they refuse to ever pick up a sword and fight again because it traumatized them so much.
So we've gone through all of the Chaos Beasts. Now, you know, 13th Age, pretty easy to make monsters. Glorantha has a huge history of great monsters that we still haven't scratched the surface on in this book. But just from all of our discussions, as a 13th Age fan, what is your favorite chaos creature that we've gone over today?
Favorite is such a weird word.
It really is.
To use in this sort of discussion. I think I would probably have to go with the dragon snails. I think that they're a good recurring monster. They do add to that escalation of heroic abilities. You know, by the time you do get later on, you really can walk back through this horde of dragon snails and take them all out. At the same time, they also have a really good Gloranthan feel and challenging opponent. They have that chaotic feel, but that they're not like mind-bendingly terrifying like Woctopus are. So I would call them probably my favorite.
Now, in opposition of that, Nick, I mean, maybe it's because I've been traumatized by the Woctopus, but the Woctopus monster has such a great ability to really create heroes in 13th Age. And since 13th Age mechanics and game and play is all about how you are the big damn hero, the Woctopus would be the thing that if your players failed one, they can go into anywhere and say, look what we did. We're amazing. So, like, yeah, I mean, the dragon snails are hysterical when you just kind of look at them, not when you fight them, but when you look at them. And the Woctopus is terrifying when you look at it. But it's going to be the one that you say, check out this, I'm a legend because of how much I succeeded.
It's a good point.
Yeah, I got two. One of them be the Woctopus. I don't know, maybe it's my illithid background and they're kind of that way. Not quite. They're almost opposite. Instead of all the mental powers, they just tear into you and physically destroy you. And like Becca said, it brings out the heroes. So if you have your normal group who has everyone's roles assigned, it's like, oh, okay, we'll let Turkus the tank go engage us, and we'll stay back and we'll pepper it. But it regenerates based on how many are not engaged with it. It's a never-ending fight that way. Everyone needs to run up and engage this thing. Then it can't regenerate. Or maybe it's only one or two, you know, the real squishy ones. So it brings out the hero. And the other one is Thanatari. I could just... Becca said it, her clan is at war with them. How about going into battle and having, you know, your baker and your blacksmith going, you failed me. Bam, here comes some spells because they've, you know, bound stuff into those clan members. I think that's just fantastic.
Yeah, it should be no surprise that the Thanatari and then the Brew are kind of my favorite Glorant. They're like, for me, the iconic Gloranthan monster that I will continually to use no matter what version of Glorantha I'm running in. And I think Rob and Jonathan gave us some really great versions of these creatures in 13th Age. What about you, Evan?
Well, besides our upcoming Wakda Scorpion, I guess I've got to go with the Jack-O-Bear. It captures both the whimsy and gonzo nature that can exist in Glorantha simultaneously with the horror of, you know, being disabled by chaos, being eaten by a ferocious monster, and your fate, you know, being worse than death. And you know, having all that packaged up in a bear with a jack-o'-lantern head, I mean, it's just doesn't get better.
All right.
How about a Thanatari with an octopus head?
Yeah, I think we can just keep making these worse and worse and worse. Becca is muted, but clearly upset at this idea. All right, so we've talked a lot about how we would use these and their role in 13th Age Glorantha. They're all bound into the mythology, into the world of Glorantha. If you were to port some of these to a more traditional F20 setting, like, say, the Dragon Empire, what if you could pick one monster, how would you pull it into the Dragon Empire and how would you use it?
Well, the Scorpion Man actually worked really well for the 13th Age game I was running. I wish I had flipped through and looked for that when they were fighting a Scorpion General. And yeah, that would probably be, the main one that I thought I would import right away because I already had a place to put it.
I've actually used the Thanatari as a cult dedicated to a previous Archmage who basically went crazy and demanded that all of the knowledge remain with them. And so they created these cults when the new Archmage took over because they were ousted. And all of these cults follow this fallen Archmage doing the same thing, taking the heads of powerful wizards so that the knowledge is, you know, kind of recaptured with this idea that they're eventually going to bring this fallen Archmage back to overthrow the 13th Age and usher in this this 14th Age of corrupted and contained, like, totalitarian control of magic.
See, I could see using the Brew, like, before a hellhole completely opens and it just starts to kind of bubble and seethe, and that chaos poisoning and changing people and animals into these chaotic beast men before it finally erupts and then demons are leading them. You know, so if you don't stop it, it opens up. Now you have demons leading the Brew, which is just horrifying.
I was thinking about trying to port the pieces of the chaotic feel into the other understanding of chaos, where it's not this, it's not entropy necessarily, it's just not law. But at the same time, trying to have that entropic feel to it and envisioning somehow maybe like a magical word that was misfired, like it's supposed to be this protective barrier to keep like magic out or dissolve magic as it's coming in and it going haywire and now starting to turn around and destroy everything, or even just a fast spreading corrupting disease or something along those lines. And the Gorp stood out to me as good options for either of those sorts of things, right? Especially if you add it to kind of play with that disease mechanic a little bit. And after you encounter the Gorp, if you have a possibility of contracting it or it being able to spread and be a little bit more prolific, as you will, I can see that really coming out and putting up a good fight against the PCs as a good arc.
Well, I like to take sort of the concept of the Spirit of Reprisal, you know, corrupted, and bring it into the Dragon Empire where, you know, instead of rune association, you have icon relationship. And so, you know, these are the servants of the icon that you have a positive or complicated relationship with. And, you know, because of that relationship, you know, these things that maybe you have seen before, maybe if you're able to introduce them as, you know, oh, these are the help, these are the messengers, these are the helpful servants, these are the, you know, maybe protective spirits that come to you from the Archmage or the Emperor or whatever. And only, oh, why are these guys, why are their eyes glowing red? And then, again, you know, the subversion of that and the fact that, you know, they're more powerful against you because in some ways they have a tie to you, but it's been subverted.
All right. Well, that wraps up our discussion of chaos in 13th Age. Any final thoughts before we do wrap up? And
just one other thought about porting it into more of an F20 game is that I would want to make the sense of chaos to be beatable, if you will, because in Glorantha you can't beat chaos, right? Even if you try, the best you could ever possibly do is maybe contain it. It's one of those core forces of nature. And at the same time, I would want to, as an option to my players and as a player, I want to have that option of actually feeling like made progress against it, or I took it out, took it down a notch. So I don't know how necessarily how I would do that, but in porting it in, I would try to make somehow that chaotic flavoring or the uprisal, if you will, be able to be contained and put down.
Well, one of the interesting things about chaos, it in Glorantha, and I feel like in some ways you could almost make a parallel to, like, for example, the Elder Gods in Call of Cthulhu. Chaos in Glorantha is representative of the way the world is broken, right? It was perfect. It now is not perfect, but there is hope in a lot of the cults. Like I think of like the Mastali cult, who are like, if we can just rebuild Mostel, everything will go back to being this perfect world before chaos broke in. And so there is one, this idea of maybe you can never beat chaos, but you can fight it back and put it back into this cycle of slumber, which is sort of right. Every 1,000 years or so, it kind of pops back up. That's like what Chaos Rising is. It's the end of the third age and the start of the fourth. But I also think that, and this speaks very much to my love of redemption stories and my love of restoration, is there are people in Glorantha who are like, it is like this, and we fight this, to use a Tolkien-esque term, the long defeat against chaos. But someday it will all be put right, and our job is to just keep fighting so that that day will eventually come.
As all right-thinking people know, in fact, everyone's understanding of the world is wrong, and of course, we are all us, and chaos is simply a part of the great balance that the goddess will bring in healing the world and the universe. And when the proper parts of chaos are integrated, and those that are excessive, just as there are excessive and old broken gods like Orlanth, and we dispose of those or we heal them and bring them in, then truly there will be a new paradise, not going backwards, but going forwards.
Spoken like the guy who is writing a lunar supplement for 13th Age Glorantha. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.